On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's come a long way on race and color assumptions in the last 50 years, but you wouldn't know it from the color of top management at the Fortune 500. In corporate executive suites, and even in the middle management, the color of money and power is still overwhelmingly white. But the country's population and markets keep changing toward more and more diversity. Now, a new generation of minority aspirants to corporate power is setting its sights on the corner office. They're frank, they're open about race, they're ambitious. They're finding new gurus and new strategies to mix it up with their white colleagues. Up next on Point, career strategies and the color of power in corporate America. Joining me now from New York is Kenneth Arroyo Roldan, CEO of the executive search firm Wesley Brown & Bartle. He's former New York State Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Bureau. His new book is Minority Rules, Turn Your Ethnicity into a Competitive Edge. Kenneth Arroyo Roldan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So you're a headhunter. You're writing about how to get ahead, strategies for getting ahead in business. Maybe there's nothing that's been more written about in the history of American publishing. Is the book different when it's for minorities in the corporate world?
Absolutely, Tom. What I try to do is provide women and people of color a non-textbook overlay of what they need to do to succeed within the corporate landscape, understanding the backdrop of the paucity of women and people of color in the marketplace at the very senior levels.
Give us the facts. If you X-ray the corner offices of the Fortune 500, what's it look like there in color and gender terms?
It looks pretty dismal, Tom. You look at the Fortune 500, there are zero Hispanic CEOs, there are 11 women CEOs, and there are 7 African-American CEOs. And more provocative to that is the fact that when you look at 26% of the population being diverse, there are only 3% of that 26% actually reside in the C-suites in corporate America, which is CEO, CFO, CIO, and the like. So it looks pretty dismal out there.
Okay, so here we are, many years after the Civil Rights Movement. We know we haven't gone to heaven in terms of race relations, and yet there's been awfully big strides made on a lot of fronts. What's your assessment at the sort of nitty-gritty level that you're taking this up as to why that that color line and gender line still looks so strong in the Fortune 500, for starters, corner offices?
Well, a lot of it has to do with power, Tom. People in power don't want to give up power. And, when you look at the landscape, while many things change, they remain the same. So as you visualize what has transpired post-Hudson Think Tank, the study that demonstrated the changing evolution of the workplace, we see it's really just a revolving door. As one African-American CEO comes in, another one leaves. And unfortunately, we are still in a point in the corporate world where majority white males just don't feel comfortable giving up the power. And the perception is if you let one person of color in or a woman, you may ghettoize the quote-unquote the C-suite.
So you're laying some responsibility at the feet of people who are already in power, but the book clearly says to minorities on the other side of that door, a lot of this is your responsibility. It depends on how you handle this challenge. What's the sort of fundamental guiding light of your advice here?
Well, the book actually is both prescriptive yet provocative, Tom. When you look at many of the books that are out there in the marketplace, they really sugarcoat this whole notion of diversity. And those people of color who have written books have really not honed in on the challenges that women and people of color face. What I'm saying to this non-traditional candidate pool is, listen, don't use the race card. Learn how to play the game. Do it well. And it's not strictly about leveling the playing field, but utilizing certain tools that I've seen in my years in providing guidance and counsel to women and people of color as they move up the corporate ladder.
You say don't buck the system. You can't change the culture. You can't change the CFO. Learn how to play the game. And you point out that never mind the CEO suite, even at the middle management levels, the sort of volume of color is way below what the country's population
would suggest, begin to take us into the nitty-gritty here, if you would, Ken. I mean, you know, down and dirty, is it different? And are you giving different advice to the candidates you're speaking to here about how to work their way into and up the corporate American power chain?
Absolutely. You know, when you look at the if you take a look inside the corporate corridors, I mean, I'm sure you've seen many times different magazines that tout, you know, best company for working mothers, best company for African Americans and for Latinos. I personally think that's a bunch of bunk. You know, when you really peel back the onion and you look inside of those organizations that are touted as being the most embracive for diversity and inclusion, they actually have the least amount of diversity and inclusion at the mid to senior ranks. We all know in today's times that many organizations have done a great job in bringing in women and people of color at the very entry level. In fact, over 75% of the Fortune 500 have their mission and value statements that somehow talk about diversity and inclusion. But the bottom line, as well as you and I know, diversity thrives in the corporate landscape when it's tied to the pocketbook. If white managers are incented to bring in folks of color that look different than they are, then they will move heaven and hell to ensure that their bonuses are, in fact, reflective of who they bring into the landscape.
You're going back to those white guys, and yet your book is really written for people who don't stand in those shoes. It's written for the person who gets through the door. Now they're inside corporate America. They've got minority colleagues. They've got white colleagues, and they want to win. So grab onto that hand here for us, Kenneth Arroyo Roldan, and begin to let us hear your advice. You say you're not going to change it. You got to figure it out and win at the rules that are there. How do you advise people to begin doing that?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when you look at the, I guess, a very visible leader in the diversity movement, you know, you think of good old Reverend Jackson, who talks about leveling the playing field. I take my advice to a different level, which is let's level the playing field, but also provide some of the tools for women and people of color to move up, and which is why I give some tips in terms of understanding the roadblocks in the landscape. The first of which I ensure women and people of color to understand is that, you know, you have to park your ego at the side, at the door. You know, we as individuals who are oftentimes the first in our families to get to a certain level of, you know, academic achievement,
yep,
enter the landscape, and, you know, we think that we have a sense of entitlement. And we come into these organizations with the mentality that you're going to influence and be able to cut across the tide. And unfortunately, that's not the way it works.
You say
whether you be a woman, a white male,
right,
or a person of color.
When you speak to this reader, you're saying, okay, you're raised in the barrio, maybe the wrong side of the tracks, but you worked hard, you went to college, you overcame the jeers of your high school classmates who called you brainiac. Now you think the world is yours for the taking when you walk across that corporate threshold. But the news from you is?
The news is there are other elements that you must take on before you move up the ladder. So it's not about being a great performer. It's about being a great performer plus utilizing many of the tips that I talk to, one of which is identifying a mentor.
Does it have to be a minority mentor? Can it be a white mentor? A male? Does it matter?
Oftentimes, it's interesting, Tom, when you look at the demographics of the corporate landscape, what those organizations that actually have a formalistic mentoring program have a propensity to partner the non-traditional person, woman and people of color, with another person that looks like them. I am a staunch advocate to ensure that as individuals come into the corporate landscape, that they ask for individuals that look different than they are. Oftentimes, if you're partnered with someone who is a woman or person of color, those individuals may be perceived as a threat to them, because oftentimes you would have a much better pedigree, you know, your experience level may be a lot more heightened than theirs has been.
Everybody needs a mentor or profits from one, whatever the color. Is it more important to minority corporate aspirants somehow?
Well, yes. And I would say, you know, based upon my years of doing this, which is almost a decade now, when you look in the corporate corridors and you see individuals that don't look like you, you often feel, you know, you have a tendency to feel lonely. So you need someone to sort of bounce ideas back and forth. You sort of need that that crutch, that emotional crutch, oftentimes. And I'm a proponent of not only looking at those that are internal mentors, but looking at external mentors, individuals who may have that functional expertise, let's say in marketing, who have been in a different organization or have been in the same organization, who could lend their knowledge base to the individual.
You've recruited plenty of executives. That means you know what the companies who want to hire people are talking, like how they're looking out at the world. Here we are in 2006. Do you see white executives as ready to reach out to people of color, to women, and be full mentors to them, be full sponsors, you know, genuinely be pleased to see them go up that corporate ladder? Or is there still some just basic color, gender resistance to that?
I don't think there's any resistance at all. I think it's more so not being able to get up to bat. When you look at the analogy of, good old Jackie Robinson, who was a phenomenal baseball player, no one knew what Jackie could deliver but for him having the opportunity at bat. I think today in the executive suite, many of the white males who have the power base are still fed these myths, one that women and people of color don't exist, and if they do exist, it's hard to find them and don't have the cultural attributes to be successful within that entity.
We've been joined by Kenneth Arroyo Roldan. He is CEO of Wesley Brown and Bartle, an executive search firm specializes in placing minority executives. He's seen a lot of this up close and personal, where the ambitions of companies and individuals are right there in front of him. He's written a new book, Minority Rules, Turn Your Ethnicity into a Competitive Edge, a kind of step-by-step, nitty-gritty strategy. We want to reach out into the world to individuals who are coming to us with experiences and expectations of their own. Joining us from Oakland, California is Noah Jackson. He's an account executive with FedEx. He handles sales in the Oakland area. He's 25 years old. He's also director of First Base Foundation, a nonprofit group that helps boys and girls develop skills that help them on and off the playing field. Noah Jackson, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
From Overland Park, Kansas, we're talking with Neil Sharma. He's CEO of Digital Evolution Group, one of the fastest-growing companies in the Kansas City area. He's 30 years old. He sits on the Board of Trustees for American University. Neil Sharma, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Hampton, Virginia, we're joined by Nandi Sharif. She's a student at Hampton University. It's a historically black university in its joint BA-MBA program. She's 18 years old. Her aspiration is to work in development at a Fortune 500 company. She's missing her golf class to join us in this hour. She's also the niece of Philip Martin, a veteran NPR reporter and an On Point producer. Nandi Sharif, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. I want you all have been listening to Ken and some of the advice he's begun to roll out for us here. I want to hear your real-world experience. Noah Jackson, there you are. You're in great big company, giant FedEx. It's got a corporate ladder a mile long. You're 25 years old, an account executive there. You're an African-American man. How does it feel? Do you feel an open road in front of you or special challenges?
I feel that there's a lot of challenges being an African-American man working in corporate America. And it's just the perception of African-American males that exist nowadays. I don't essentially feel that there's an open road for me and there's a clear-cut path at all. I think it, through every door, around every corner, there faces an enormous challenge that I do not yet know even is there.
Now, I bet you that FedEx has in great big letters in some book of theirs that they're committed to diversity and minority advancement. Do you know of such a policy, and does it work, or do you depend on a policy? Do you need policy to move ahead?
There is a lot of diversity, but where you see it happen is on the lower level. So, for example, the majority of our drivers are, a lot of minorities. The majority of upper management, not so much. I have a female manager right now, and I've had, female managers in the past as well. So there is advancement, but only to certain levels in certain areas. If you look at on the upper echelon of the whole entire company, you can see that that picture is very jaded. In the lower parts, there is that availability for diversity.
Okay, you're a competitor. You're a player. You played baseball, University of California, Berkeley. I mean, you know what it takes to get in the game. So here you've moved from that athletic field, which you still pay attention to with kids. You're in the corporate field. Are your instincts working here? Have you found the way to work this corporate system, or are you still struggling with it?
I don't really know if there's a way to essentially work the corporate system. The big thing for me is I never want to repress who I am as a person. And I think that it's very important to be me first and not be untrue to myself. So what I mean by that is that if I have a strong personality, which I do, if I have a strong drive and work ethic, I need to make that stand out. And I don't want to change who I am just to make sure that somebody else will like me, just to push me up the corporate ladder.
When you say you want to be true to yourself, Kenneth Arroyo Roldan, speak to Noah Jackson here. He wants to be true to himself. Who doesn't? How does ethnicity play into that, Ken, when it comes to corporate advancement?
Well, I applaud Noah in his passion for wanting to move up the ladder, and he's absolutely clear when he looks at FedEx as an organization. You know, I've made many presentations to FedEx corporate offices, and at the time that I presented him, there was one person of color at the very senior levels, but not having much power. And he was in the HR role,
yep,
which typically exists in corporate America. You know, they'll bring in an African-American or Latino, put him in the diversity role in HR and hoping to populate the ranks. But oftentimes, they only do a good job at the entry level. So I understand Noah's pain, but I agree with him that, you know, the book talks to not necessarily, you know, hiding who you are. Be proud of who you are and what you represent.
But you say don't play the race card. What's the difference?
Well, with the race card, again, we're looking at a total dichotomy here. You know, the perception today in today's landscape is that people of color are still wanting to use the race card. It's about affirmative action. It's about quotas. What we're saying is that there's a new wave of women and people of color coming to the marketplace, and they're all about performance. It's not the individuals of back when that were beneficiaries of affirmative action. These are individuals who are hard workers. These are individuals who have great pedigrees, and it's a matter of being able to give them the opportunity to move up the ladder. And oftentimes, that's the challenge. This is where you have the phenomenon of, you know, the glass ceiling or granite walls.
Let me turn to Overland Park, Kansas, just outside Kansas City, and Neil Sharma. Neil, you're CEO of Digital Evolution Group. You're 30 years old. You've got your own company going here. And I suppose, as an American of Indian descent, you've got your own kind of corporate or ethnic mythology that you're dealing with. Do you find it helpful or difficult? How was race and minority status come into your career?
Well, I think it's cut both ways for me. I think the double-edged sword characterization is probably the best characterization that I could come up with. I operate in the internet industry, or the web has largely been associated with Indians, and a lot of programmers and engineers at a lot of major corporations are Indian. So there is a natural predisposition to think that we are, or I am, technically oriented, and I think that obviously works in my favor when I walk in a room or when I make a presentation. At the same time, if that becomes the sort of sum total of the estimation of me,
the tech guy, the guy from India,
right? Exactly, right. Then that's when I start to feel undermined, and that's when I start to believe that it's working against me.
Did you start your own company along with your partners because you feared that you might face a headwind in established corporate America, or just because you're entrepreneurial?
I think largely because of the entrepreneurial spirit that I had and my business partners had. But I think more than anything, just to speak to the point that the author was discussing earlier, I think as a matter of personal dignity, most people want to be valued for their contribution, period. Nobody really wants to be wondering if they got ahead or if their peer got ahead solely on the basis of race or gender.
Mm-hmm.
So in the entrepreneurial environment, it was an environment for me to be able to be solely valued on the basis of my contribution. At least I felt so. Now, I do believe that there are still instances and a lot of situations where some people's contributions are undermined. So they're not valued for that. They're undervalued, largely on the basis of this sophisticated discrimination that the author speaks of, or because of prejudice, or because of this mythology that exists out there as it relates to people of color and gender.
Kenneth Arroyo Roldan, here we've got Neil Sharma. He's CEO of his own company of Indian descent. I mean, you can certainly you can call him a minority, but he's saying, well, in his case, it's a double-edged sword. He gets a kind of wide open arms on the technical side, you know, by people stereotyping, oh, Indians good at engineering, good at math, good at high tech, but maybe some limitations when he reaches beyond that. as an executive recruiter, you must sense that diversity in the way color and particular ethnicity works for and against candidates all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, when you look at the stigma that's associated with both not only Indians but also Asian Americans, they too have that stigma of, you know, the engineer or the engineered coming in.
Well, it's a stigma, but it can get you in the door.
Well, oftentimes it can also be a blocker, because oftentimes as we work with many organizations, the interest is to populate a certain functional area exclusive of Indians and Asians because there is such an abundance of those individuals within the marketplace. So it does work both ways. But it's interesting when you look at Pepsi, that just anointed Indra Nooyi to be the new CEO of Pepsi.
Right,
She will clearly be able to set precedent that would hopefully shed some light on the phenomena that Noah speaks to, which is, you know, historically, Asians and as well as Indians have been perceived as, you know, having this technical prowess. Here we have someone in the consumer packaged goods industry that's going to be able to hopefully turn the industry upside down.
Let's talk to a young African-American woman, 18 years old, who's got her sights on big things. Nandi Sharif is with us from Hampton University. Nandi, tell us about your ambitions. What do you want to do?
Well, Tom, my ambitions just include going into the field of professional development. And although it is a sector of human resources, I really want to focus on creating seminars, workshops, and conferences for companies, eventually having my own consulting firm and doing my own, but having those conferences, workshops, and seminars, and teaching executives how to value their employees more, and teaching employees how to value themselves and really see themselves, find their niche in order to increase retention and productivity.
So watch out, Kenneth Arroyo Roldan. You may have Nandi on your tail one day. Nandi, you're at Hampton University and in the joint MBA, BA MBA program. What's that like?
It is absolutely an excellent program. It's accelerated, so I am taking a lot of classes. I have a very heavy load, but I'm also exposed to a lot of different things. For example, you said I'm missing my golf class. I have to take golf. We're also required to take tennis, chess, and Japanese kendo. And so for tennis and golf, these things are teaching us basically how to make those deals on the golf course, on the tennis court.
Wow. So this is, they take it all the way to the golf course. And I've read here also certain days of the week you dress in full business attire. Certain aspects, cultural aspects kind of suppressed. No cornrow hairdos here.
Yes. As a matter of fact, we have an extreme hair policy, and cornrows, locks, or single braids are not allowed for the males.
How do you and your fellow students feel about that?
Wow, there are really mixed reviews on that one. I believe that it's important to recommend, make a strong recommendation about the fact that when you look at the CEOs, when you look at all these chief executives in corporate America, when they mirror the image of an African-American, what you see is someone who has a conservative hairstyle. Mm-hmm. And so that recommendation is important because we need to know what we're going to look like in 10, 15 years. But at the same time, I feel like we're moving into a new model of diversity. I feel as if you shouldn't be judged just on what your hair looks like. Even though presentation is very important, I feel like performance should count as more.
So you're aiming at the Fortune 500. You're at a black college, historically black college. What do your professors tell you about the American corporate world you're headed into as a young African American? Do they you know, name it and frame it right up front, saying race will be a factor in the way you're received? Here's how to deal with it.
Honestly, the 5-year MBA program, when you come into it, you kind of know that that's what's going on, and the expectation of you is that you will work your hardest, go up to your full potential in order to realize who you really are. And so that's why we have the classes that we have. We take 6 accounting courses, including 2 in graduate school. We advance ourselves in this way so that we know, okay, we already know that the barrier is here. We need to move forward. We need to say we're going to work harder anyway in order to, you know, improve ourselves and advance ourselves, so when we come to the table, when we get our internships, when we receive our job opportunities, we're already 5-10 steps ahead.
Ken, you can hear the ambition here, the eagerness to go get it, the determination. Do you see a new day dawning, a new generation that may face a different kind of reception in corporate America, or is it the same old story when Nandi gets at the, you know, the door of the big company a few years from now?
Well, it's quite dismal, Nandi, and I don't think it'll change in your lifetime or your kids' lifetime. You know, when you look at the corporate shift look at last 50 years of corporate America, it has been pretty much the same type of policies, you know, regardless of our buying power as women and people of color, which is now approaching close to $1 trillion in the year 2010. Again, we're assuming there's going to be a large shift within the C-suite in how people act, how they look at one another. I mean, me being on the front lines all the time in the corporate landscape, I still hear from corporate executives, bring me a Colin Powell, bring me a Condoleezza Rice.
And what's your response when they say that? What are you thinking when they say that?
Well, I'm thinking that, again, they are fed the intelligence based upon what our industry feeds them. Okay, the executive search industry, which holds all the information, these coveted jobs that don't appear in the New York Times or the Tribune or whatever.
But when someone asks you for a Condi Rice or a Colin Powell, is that a problem? I mean, they're opening the door there.
Well, I think that just talks to their limit in understanding the diverse landscape. It's not necessarily a racist comment, but more so an ignorance comment. They are just not keen as to the idea that women and people of color do exist with great pedigrees, with great experience. I mean, but for, Indra being named or Andrea Jung being named or Ken Chenault being named, these individuals at one point were mid-managers.
They don't all necessarily come as former Secretary of States.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, the perception is that you need to have a super performer. Or one that is recognized. But oftentimes, again, the way I perceive corporate America right now as it relates to diversity, it tends to be an inoculation. Give me a one-time booster of a person of color at the mid to senior levels, and I'm done.
Give me just a little, and I'll put it out there. Nandi, are you prepared to accept the Ken here saying it's going to be quite dismal out there? Or do you think your generation will change it or find a different world?
Honestly, I understand exactly where Kenneth is coming from. Our dean and our director talked to us about these things as well, saying, you know, things may not change. And really, the five-year MBA program, it teaches us how to fit well and how to achieve where the levels are and really how to find out what the corporate culture is. And so I do understand and recognize the fact that I may have challenges in terms of advancing, maybe changing the landscape of how things look. However, I know that I'm willing to do that. I know I'm willing to fit where I need to fit, work how I need to work, because that's the type of person I already am. I'm already an overachiever. I do the things that I need to do. And hopefully, as I set that example, as I do those things, maybe it'll trickle down to somebody else.
We've had a lot of listeners waiting to get into this wonderfully crowded field. Let's go to Waco, Texas. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Yes. I wanted to make a comment about affirmative action and how I felt it was undermined in the workplace by the fact that about the same time that affirmative action came in, I noticed that there was a shift of with corporate entities to no longer allow people to just work from the bottom up, you know, up the corporate ladder, and requiring individuals to have a college education in order to get to another level of the corporate ladder. And
does that seem unfair or a particular roadblock for people of color to you, Sam?
Yeah, definitely, because at that point, I think that like 2-3% of Hispanics were graduating from college. And so, I mean, that really reduced the chances of you making it up in the world if you did not have that college education. Right now, I believe there's 12% of Hispanics are graduating from college, which is still, you know, making that playing field even much smaller. I noticed, I've worked in the corporate world for about 20 years,
Yeah. And
I've noticed that in the upper management, it's particularly white. And anybody that's doing lower level work, cleaning, cooking, they're usually Hispanic and African American, and that is how they kind of fill their affirmative action quota.
And if your ticket wasn't punched in the first place with that college degree, pretty hard to move off the dime there. Sam, thanks for your call. Kenneth, how do you look at affirmative action? What do you have to say about it in Minority Rules?
Well, again, the point that I'm bringing up is clearly affirmative action is really an offshoot of what Title VII, the Civil Rights Movement, was about, which was providing women and people of color with opportunities that they didn't have. So in order to try to level the playing field, organizations were embracing affirmative action programs, looking at quotas. But in the corporate landscape today, in the year 2006, organizations have moved away from that paradigm and are now looking at being able to bring in talented individuals, not focusing on affirmative action, not focusing on quotas, and hiring the best talent. What I'm saying in my book is that, again, the theme is many are selected, few are chosen. And what happens here is that when you look at being able to populate the mid to senior management ranks and you're trying to bring in an infusion of the best qualified individual, time and time again, when an organization decides to pull the trigger and hire someone, whether it be a CEO, a director of finance, they're only looking at a lily white slate. There's no person of color that's positioned to be able to be considered. So it's not even a matter of leveling the playing field. You can't level the playing field if there's no one up at bat.
You're describing the majority of Black, Latino, and ethnics who are joining corporate America but leaving after 5 to 7 years because they're not seeing that advancement, so they're not there in the ranks ready to be moved on up, you're saying.
Great point, Tom. You know, when you look at the corporate landscape, organizations in today's time have diversity fatigue. To Nandi's point in her pursuit of being able to go into the professional development of executives, there still is a systemic feeling inside corporations about this notion of, you know, diversity or sensitivity training or doing the right thing with women and people of color or giving back to the community. That is all great. But when you peel the onion back even further, there is nothing being done about developing women and people of color. So great organizations go out there. They do great recruitment at the historical Black colleges, universities, the other universities that are out there in the marketplace. But when they bring them in, they do not get developed. And the 5 to 7 year syndrome, what happens is when they are learning and they're, you know, getting the training that's necessary, and when they look up, there's no one that looks like them. So they're getting great performance reviews, but nevertheless, they're seeing their majority counterparts moving up quicker with less performance criteria and less degrees, for that matter.
We're trying to see our way out of exactly that. Noah Jackson, how do you see it with FedEx there in Oakland? Affirmative action, a good thing, a bad thing, a stigma? Do you need it or do you not want to get near it?
I believe affirmative action is definitely needed, but the problem with affirmative action is that you have companies who try to fill quotas, and like Kenneth was saying, it's not so much something that exists in upper management, upper echelon of the company. It's something that exists at the bottom, and it's just a lot of companies step in and say, okay, well, we need X amount of minorities. Let's just go out and get them for the remedial jobs, essentially.
Neil Sharma, you've got your own company there, a person of color, yet in this different category of American, of Indian descent. How do you look at affirmative action and the attitudes around it?
Well, I think personally, I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think it still has an appropriate place in our society because the individual contributions often, in a lot of situations, are still undermined by prejudice or the sophisticated discrimination that the author speaks of. At the same time, I think that a lot of the sort of mistrust in the corporate ranks in terms of the advancement of minorities and of women as a result of affirmative action is there's a lot of mistrust as it relates to the fact that everyone might be wondering whether someone got ahead because of solely on the basis of filling a quota. So they moved them ahead. Now, it was really interesting when the author had just mentioned that, minorities and individuals of color, minorities and gender are in a bad situation, even though their performance is increased. Because in our industry, it doesn't seem like that is the case. It's a very egalitarian industry.
I mean, if people perform up, they'll go.
Right, exactly. It's a very egalitarian industry, and as performance sort of leads the way, so does advancement.
You said that you've seen sometimes problems with an inappropriate sense of entitlement among people of color. What do you mean by that, Neil?
I think there's an expectation that, and oftentimes when I give speeches in front of MBA classes and, even sort of urban youth, this idea that there's an expectation that they'll be advanced regardless of the basis of their performance or their merit. In the Midwest, in our environment, there's not a lot of minorities that are around. As a result, what ends up happening is whenever you see minorities who advance to a higher position, there always is some degree of suspicion around whether their advancement was due to really performance or whether their advancement was really due to just their minority status.
Nandi, you're 18 years old. Among your classmates, do you have any doubt that you're going to have to make it on your own? Do you want affirmative action? Do you see it as a potential, you know, blessing or curse? How do you look at it?
I believe, and I take on a different perspective, I think affirmative action is more important in terms of pre-professional. And what I mean by that is the programs that you get into, the MBA programs that you get into, if you decide you wanted to get a PhD or doctorate or something like that, getting into those programs, being prepared.
To get you lined up for the education.
Lined up mm-hmm. for the education so that we'll be prepared to take on the issues that we need to take on, be prepared to present, be prepared to basically take on corporate America. I think that's more important in terms of the affirmative action. I feel as if once you get there and you perform, I know Kenneth was talking about even the people that I performed, mm-hmm. I looked over, I still think that it's very important to perform 150% when other people are performing 98%.
Sounds like you're ready to do it. John Ma's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. John Ma, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well, ma'am. What do you see out there?
Well, I have my own company.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in business for 12 years. And what I have had to deal with as a minority female-owned company is not being labeled a minority female-owned company. And I feel that that was very strong for me to set myself apart, but not...
You don't want the label. No, thank you.
No, thank you.
And why not?
Because what I found out over the years is that when you compete with the label, there's a low expectation that you're going to deliver the service.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the service industry. I own a pest control company.
Have you been able to escape it? Have you been able to establish your company and yourself without that?
I've been able to establish my company without it. I have a national name, a national brand, and everyone recognized that.
Mm-hmm.
And people come. Well, here's what I found out from... Now that I'm dealing with corporate executives at the top,
mm-hmm.
they come to me and say, one-on-one, I'm glad you didn't compete as a minority-owned company. I have more respect for you because you didn't.
So you win some credit just for that.
I win credit for that. Now, here, I'm not saying not to compete, but in my chosen field, I decided to pick when I wanted to compete. I had control of the process because down south, I'm in Nashville,
mm-hmm.
a lot of times the people that are running the diversity program, it's just an extension of the marketing program. It's they spend more money advertising that they have a diversity program than they actually spend minority dollars.
It's not a pipeline to the corner office. It's a pipeline to the corporate PR brochure.
Right. It's part of the brochure. It's part of marketing. And if
Absolutely.
if you're smart... You know, you understand that. Here's where I had found I've learned not to be in the middle, not to deal with a middle person.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times diversity coordinators and small business liaison, they have to answer to a VP of something.
And you want to talk to the VP. Gentlemen, let me ask you, you've got Nandi here on the air with you. She's 18. She's African-American. She's out to beat the world. Can you see any reason you've been out there? Any reason she shouldn't aim for that corner office for the top slot?
If she wants to be in corporate America, then
and
that's
she does.
Great. And I think that's awesome. I have a son in college as well, and I'm just ecstatic to hear her and her energy. When I was in school, I didn't have no one told me that I could compete as an entrepreneur. I just kind of fell into it. So it's exciting to know that she's going into it with her eyes far more open than I had.
John, We hear that blessing onto the next generation, and we thank you for your call. We wish you good luck with the business there. Let me get a call from Boston and Gustavo. Hi, Gustavo. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because basically I work with a company, Edward Jones Investments, and the company set up an inclusion program to help minority financial advisors feel comfortable in a field that's overwhelmingly white and male, and I was asked to go into the program 3 times, and I turned it down. I finally decided to go because to go fly to St. Louis and take part in this program just to see what it was like.
And is it the real deal or is it window dressing?
No, it was a real deal. They brought 12 financial advisors from around the country, all of us of color or Muslim or, you know, something that made us a little bit outside of the average financial advisor. And part of my training program that week, I sat in with John Jacobs, who was the president of the Urban League for many years, and now he's a senior executive at Anheuser-Busch. And he came to Edward Jones and said, the reason that companies bring you in, meaning minority,
yep,
because they want you to bring your community to the company. And you've got to remember that.
Is that fair?
It actually opened my eyes to something, because I had not wanted to be thought of, just as a previous caller, I didn't want to be thought of for my minority status.
But are you just as happy to also be seen as a conduit to that community, or does that seem somehow offensive to you?
It opened my mind to it, and I know I'm much more active with the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and the Latino Professional Network and other organizations here in the Boston area that all of a sudden I said, you know what, I have not really focused this closely on that, and it's exciting.
So there's the embrace of it. Gustavo, we wish you luck with that. Let me get a call from Mike in Boston, if I may. Mike, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you, Tom. First-time caller. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you, Mike.
I wanted to talk about, because I'm actually a physician. I have a business degree, and I went to Harvard and Johns Hopkins. I probably have some of the best education in the solar system. But I have always taken some issue with this idea that we do live within corporate America and a meritocracy, and that it's almost unfair. If you're a minority person, you almost have to be overly prepared for the same kind of placement or advancement or promotion. And I really do mean that. I mean, you have to have, you know, an outstanding pedigree. You have to be articulate, dressed well, sharp. I mean, you know.
So what's your attitude toward that? It's like they're asking too much, so don't do it, or it's the only way, so do it?
No, I'm just, it's just my own experience, of course, but this idea that preparation enough is enough for advancement is not the case. It is a necessary but insufficient condition for advancement. I think I haven't read this author's book, but I think he's right, and I don't want to share his pessimism, but you get your foot in the door, you begin to advance in the middle ranks, you get to a certain point, and then at that point, even if you've gone to Yale and Harvard and Brooks Brothers and everything else,
right,
it's not necessarily a guarantee that you're going to be able to take, you know, the next step. There are a whole range of subjective factors, including, and I will say that I've changed jobs a lot in my career,
yeah.
There's a whole sort of networking that goes on here. It's really about, you know, do people know you in your social network? Like, that's how actually you get these jobs. I mean, the headhunters call, and basically you recommend people that, yes, you've worked with, that you enjoy working with, that have some of the street cred and the background.
And then things get really subtle, and we understand that we've barely had time to touch it. And, Mike, our time is short now, but I appreciate your call. Kenneth Arroyo Roldan, you say turn your ethnicity into a competitive advantage. How?
Well, again, not necessarily wearing your badge of color or race or gender on your arm. You know, whether you want to wear cornrows is one thing, but, you know, to succeed in corporate America, you have to dress and play the role. So as it relates to turning your ethnicity to a competitive edge, what I'm sharing is to increase the bottom line, like Gustavo is trying to facilitate at Edward Jones, opening up Edward Jones to the diverse wealth that's out there in the Latino market. You have to be able to be shrewd. Whether you're a woman, whether you're Indian descent or Asian, you have to be able to turn your ethnicity to a competitive advantage to increase the bottom line. It's all about dollars and cents. And if you could use that to your advantage, then go forth and you will clearly move up the ranks.
You know, we've just begun to crack this, and I hope we can get back to it. But I'm so grateful to each of you for being with us this hour. In Oakland, California, Noah Jackson at FedEx. Noah, good luck there. Go get it, my friend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Neil Sharma in Overland, Kansas, Overland Park, Kansas, CEO of Digital Evolution Group. Neil, thanks a lot. Good luck with the company.
Thank you very much.
Nandi Sharif in Hampton University, Hampton, Virginia. Nandi, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Kenneth, wonderful to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.